The subject that we're going to talk about tonight is this article by Professor Katz on the history of the development of Metzitza, the law is relevant to do with Metzitza, which, as you know, is part of the Mila ceremony, where the Moel, after cutting off the foreskin and peeling back the membrane underneath, sucks out the blood. And those are sort of the three physical operations that are performed at the time of Mila. I'm particularly emotionally attached to this particular article because about whenever this appeared, I guess 10 or even more years ago, suddenly out of the blue, I got a call from Professor Katz, and he wanted to discuss a particular Teres Yisrael, and we had never talked about this before, and he wanted my take on this particular Teferis Yisrael that we'll study a little bit later tonight. Certainly Professor Katz didn't need my opinion. I think he probably knew that my take on it would be slightly different from his, and in fact it was slightly different from his, and my take on the whole subject is slightly different from his. That is, as we will discover in the course of the evening, I think that there's much more of an ideological component in addition to the normal sociological component and flag component to this whole issue. And it's coming back to haunt us because of recent events and upcoming events. So let me begin this by reminding you of this quotation that I like to quote several times of Rav Shvira Gaon. The Talmud in over 1,000 years ago, and the Talmud in Gittin lists a whole list of home remedies written in some arcane Aramaic language, and the correspondent wrote to Rav Shvira Gaon, could he please translate these different medical terms into plain Arabic, or whatever language was the one that he wanted to have the thing translated into. And this is what Rav Shvira Gaon writes. This is about Rav Shvira Gaon was in Baghdad, yes, and or wherever, yes, in Babylonia. And the correspondent was presumably, well, we don't know exactly, probably, maybe in North Africa, we're not sure. Okay. So let's read what he has to say. You asked me to write to you these various medications which occur in the chapter in Masechet Gittin, which is entitled Misha Oxel Kordaikos, some kind of cardiac translation into Hebrew. And what is our tradition on this matter, and please explain it in modern language. So this is his response. Tzlichin anan lemeimo lachon, lemeimo lachon, derabbanon lav asuta intim. We're obliged to inform you that rabbis are not medical doctors. They collected various items and listed them, but they are not commandments. Therefore, you should not rely on these medicines and should not do any of these things until it has been checked out and certified by knowledgeable medical doctors that these things do no harm and do not lead to danger. We have been taught thus by our fathers and our grandfathers not to perform any of these remedies other than what has been established, and so on. So, perfectly straightforward statement. Don't trust any medical advice that is stated in the Talmud. So, this is Rav Shvira Gaon before the 19th century, 1,000 years before the 19th century, but before the FDA, but mainly before the conflict between the Reform and the Orthodox in the 19th century. Okay, now, let's, having this advice of Rav Shira Gaon in mind, let's turn to some of the Talmudic sources. Okay? The Gemara in Shabbos says, Motzitzin, Amar Rav Papa, Hai Umna the Lo Mayitz, any surgeon who does not suck out the wound of the Brit Milah, of the circumcision, Sakanahu ve'avrinan le. This is dangerous. It's dangerous not to suck out the blood, and he should be fired. This seems to indicate that there was some standard of licensing where the surgeons in the town would actually perform the mila, and if they refused to take the necessary medical steps, would be fired. What the medical hypothesis is, that sucking on the wound is a life-saving medication, and not doing it would render the child in mortal danger, I don't know. In a moment, I mean, I have no idea what the actual underlying medical theory was. In a bit, we'll see what the Rambam's take on this medical theory was in terms of Galenic doctrine. But
I think they were drawn the blood from somewhere else.
That's what the Rambam says, but what does that mean? Right? Well, at any event, I don't know whether the Gemara's interpretation matches the Rambam's, but I certainly know that the Rambam's interpretation has no status whatsoever in modern medicine. Okay, but at any rate, let's finish with the Gemara here. All right, Mahu detema haydam nifkat poki. You might, Pshita the Gemara says, of course, the makachalili aleh shabta. Will certainly fire a surgeon who's unwilling to take this step, because after all, this step is regarded as so serious that you're allowed to perform it even on Shabbat, if the Brit Milah occurs on Shabbat. Since this is not an integral part of the Brit Milah ceremony, therefore it in and of itself would not be Dokeh Shabbat, and therefore the only reason that this could be considered as being Dokeh Shabbat is because it represents a sakan. You might think that the blood that actually comes out of this wound is already stored there, and therefore there's no violation of the Sabbath law by simply letting blood that's already stored in an organ out. It's only a violation of the Sabbath law if the blood is drawn out. But if the blood is already stored up there and you're just letting it out, this is not a violation. And it's similar to the application of a bandage and of cumin. My isplanis v'kamon kilo ovid sakanahi. If you don't put the bandage on the wound or apply cumin, which is something that aids in the coagulation of the blood, if you don't do that, it's dangerous. What is a coagulant? The cumin acting as a coagulant. It's dangerous, and therefore you're allowed to do it on Shabbat. Similarly, okay, this is the Gemara, straightforward. Alright, now let's take a look at the Rambam's take on this. Ketzad mohalin, what is the procedure for performing mila? Chodchinet kol ha'or machapeh ha'tara ad shetgalet kol ha'tara. You cut off all of the foreskin that is covering the glands until the glands is disclosed, and then you remove the membrane, presumably some smegma which is solidified on the glands under it with your fingernails, until the glands becomes completely visible, and then you suck out on the mila, until blood actually arises there from the faraway places, kidei shelo yavo lidei sakana. So the Rambam's theory is that the purpose of the metzitza is to draw the blood from faraway places. Remember, according to Galenic doctrine, blood is only in the veins. They didn't know anything about capillaries, and the arteries were full of air or some mixture of air and blood, but normally there would not be blood here, and since the blood is a healing mechanism from the wound, you have to draw the blood from faraway places to the wound. V'chol mi she'eino motzeitz ma'avirin oto v'achar she'motzeitz noten ela asplanit erotiyah opiyotzei b'hem. And after that's done, you put on a bandage or a wet bandage or something, whatever is necessary to help aid in the healing of the wound. Maluat akatan b'shabbat v'achakach nishbachu achamin onitz fazru hasamamin. If you if the milah was performed on Shabbat and somehow or other the hot water that was needed to cleanse the whole baby and the boy was spilled out, or the pharmaceuticals got scattered. Osimlo hakol b'Shabbat nutnei shasakana hilo. Okay, makom shedarkon lahalchitzet hakatan machitzinato b'Shabbat b'yom hamilah bein lefnei hamilah bein la'achah hamilah. In those places where it was customary to wash the child on at the day of circumcision, you do it on Shabbat, whether the custom was to wash him before or after with milah. Similarly, because the theory was that the third day after an operation was the most, was the day of crisis, therefore it was also permissible to wash the child in hot water even on Shabbat. Bein uchitzat kol gufo, bein uchitzat milah, bein b'chamin shehukmu b'yarav Shabbat, bein b'chamin shehukmu b'shabbat mitnei shesakana hula. In other words, it's permissible to boil up water, if you, for some reason or other you don't have any hot water, it's permissible to boil up water on Shabbat, either on the day of the milah itself, or on the third day. Okay? Yes?
Does Rambam specify the preparation for the instrument to the milah?
No. I mean, he specifies that any instrument is valid.
Were they allowed to be
No, they, nobody knew about infection in those days, but they know about cleanliness.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there could be, even today, a reason for matzitsa in that when you have a wound, medical advices that you should, and it's not bleeding, medical advices you should squeeze out a little blood, because that in itself cleans out, the blood coming out cleans out any germs.
Yeah,
so,
but your mouth is certainly not a sterile organ. You're producing all kinds of germs.
Well, that's another thing, but...
Right.
Didn't they drink before they did it?
In fact, there is universal medical opinion from the beginning of the 19th century onward that this served no medical purpose and, in fact, caused danger, precisely because of infection. Okay? Now, let's look at the Shulchan Aruch. Din milah b'Shabbat uvo asara seifim. Osin kol tzarkei milah b'Shabbat. One is allowed to perform all of the needs of milah on Shabbat. Mohalin, uporin, umotzitzin, v'notnim alav kemo. You can actually perform the circumcision, perform the ripping of the membrane underneath, you suck out the wound and apply cumin, okay? And it goes through a whole lot of things. I'll skip all of them until the last one. Let's go to number 9 on the next page. Tet. Bizman Chachmei HaGemara. At the time of the Talmud, im lo hayu rochatzin et havlad lefnei hamila ulachar hamila uviyom hashlishi lefmila b'mayim chamim haya musukan. Lefichach nizkuku lechtov nishpato kishachal liyot b'shabbat. Therefore, they had to write a specific rule saying that you were allowed to heat up the water if the hot water got spilled, etc. What to do for a child if the milah or the third day of the milah falls on Shabbat. V'ha'idna, today lo nahagu b'rochitza klal. But nowadays, our custom is not to perform this rochitza. V'dino l'rochos v'shabbat im ratzu k'din rochitzat kol adam. And therefore, the washing of a child on Shabbat today, says the Shulchan Aruch, is just the same rules that would apply to washing any other person. In particular, you're not allowed to heat up hot water on Shabbat to wash the child in order to save its life. Okay, and then he gives a whole list of rules on how to do this. Right? So let's summarize. There are two medical operations that are mentioned in the Talmud. One is the sucking of the womb, and the second is washing in hot water, which makes more sense to us today, perhaps. But the Shulchan Aruch was perfectly willing to say that nowadays we don't do that, that we don't follow the medical advice of the Talmud when it comes to the issue of heating up hot water to rinse, wash, get sterile water to...
Shulchan Aruch was a little, somewhat careful in the language, but to use the word, high on the sukkan, so it could be interpreted as he's saying that, like sometimes the cover that they use is that in those days it was dangerous, nowadays it's not.
Right, that is a standard cover, and we will try to discuss the meaning of this standard cover, and it's an important ingredient for us. Namely, this cover, which technically known as nishtanu hatva'in, nature has changed. In the old days, it was indeed dangerous for a child to go without being washed and have his brit milah, without being washed in hot water before or after or whatever. But nowadays, in the 16th century, our children have a different nature, and therefore it is no longer dangerous not to wash them. Okay? Or, as you could say, probably more correctly, that this was just a euphemism, a cover. Namely, that instead of out and out saying, like Rav Shneur Gaon was quite capable of saying 600 years prior to the time of the Shulchan Aruch, namely, that rabbis are not doctors, and therefore you have to follow your current medical advice and don't pay attention to specific medical advice that the Talmud would get, the Shulchan Aruch was a little bit more careful in his choice of language and didn't want to say that out and out. Why cause waves? Nowadays we don't do it. Yes.
Does the Gemara actually discuss the washing?
Yes.
In this?
Yes.
In
Masechet Shabbat it also discusses washing.
Oh, okay, but you don't have it.
I don't think I may or may not have. I have. Yeah. No, I didn't bring that. Okay. But it's in the Gemara. Okay. All right. So, at the beginning of the 19th century, when, as Professor Katz points out, people were beginning, there was a syphilis scare. People were afraid about contagious diseases, although not quite yet having developed the germ theory of disease. They sort of knew that diseases were transmitted, and therefore there was certainly a danger involved. And secondly, of course, as Professor Katz points out, this began to be thought of as disgusting, ekelhaftig, to quote the original German. The rabbi in Vienna wrote to his master, the Chatam Sofer, in Pressburg at the time, asking whether they could, instead of sucking out the wound, apply some other means of drawing the blood, say applying a sponge. No, a sponge. Right? They didn't have the notion of antiseptic sponge yet, but a sponge, okay? The Chatam Sofer, just taking the Gemara straight at its value, right? So here's the exchange of letters. Kasher chadashim mikarov kara mikve pol ireinu v'kam yoladim nimolim mimohel echad mumche asher parcha ba'or b'saram tzara'at mam erek. There are several children who were circumcised by a certified mohel who then got some skin disease, and several children, many children died from these boys. The doctors here, that is in Vienna, thought that the epidemic that was striking these children derived from the fact that the mohel was performing mitzitza. In all fairness, Professor Katz points out that they examined the mohel for signs of syphilis and didn't see any flaws, but nevertheless, as a general medical practice, they felt that it would be best to replace the mitzitza by some other means. Now, the mar was not found to be infected. Right, they did not see any sores in his mouth, for example, or whatever. But in any event, the doctors quite correctly decided that this was an unsanitary and possibly contagious practice, and therefore wanted to provide an alternative. Okay? And the Chatam Sofer wrote that he ain davar sheyitnaged lazeh mitzad datenu hakdoshah. There is nothing in our religion which should object to this. The zilbata ta'amo. Go after the reason for the commandment to perform mitzitzah. Lama hitzvichu chazal kol ikar ha-mitzitzah. The whole purpose of the mitzitzah, mishum ufuat animal, because of the medical benefits to the child. Va'arei me'idim rofim mulkim shegam hasvogo sepa ula hiti yotzeba. The expert doctors say that the sponge will have the same effect as the actual mitzitzah. Why shouldn't we believe the doctors on this matter? Like many medical procedures which have been recently invented, which were not even imagined in the early days. So the Chatam Sofer responded immediately. Okay. This is in the 1830s. Professor Katz gives the exact date. In the 1830s, thereabouts. The Chatam Sofer died in the 1840s, I believe. Now, this particular tshuva of the Chatam Sofer, I could not reproduce for you because it is not reprinted in his collected works. His estate decided that it was too radical to be reproduced in his collected works. I didn't find it. I knew of its existence because it's mentioned in various places. For example, in Kohat's Oroch on Uman, he mentions it, and other people have referred to it in passing, as we will see. In fact, it was published in a journal called Kochavei Yitzchak, which Widener Library doesn't have. Obviously, Professor Katz had access to this at the Hebrew University Library, so he saw the actual tshuva, and there it is. Okay. Now, that was the status in 1830. Okay. Now, to show you, and here's where my take, I think, is a bit different than Professor Katz's, but we will go through it. First of all, you have to ask, what's so shocking about this? After all, first of all, the Rav Shmuel said that rabbis are not doctors. And secondly, the other of the medical operations that is prescribed by the Gemara, namely heating the water and washing the child, was no longer regarded as necessary to perform, to the extent that you're not allowed to do it on Shabbat if it involves cooking up the water on Shabbat. That's explicit in the Shulchan Aruch. So although the language may be somewhat forward-looking, the actual decision is routine. One would not have imagined that this could cause such controversy. Okay? Now, let me skip to the 1990s and then go back to the whole history of the story. There is, as you say, a distinguished professor, the head of the, what is it, neurology department at Shaarei Tzedek, and a professor at Hadassah Medical School, and who's one of the leading experts on medicine and Jewish law, has published a five-volume work called Encyclopedia Hilchatit Rufuit. This is the Encyclopedia of Halachic Medicine. The author is Dr. Abraham Steinberg, right? And
Rabbi Weinberg's son-in-law.
Who's Rabbi Weinberg?
He was a rabbi in Morgan. He was the principal of Maimonides for a while.
I don't know.
You know Charlie, yeah. His son-in-law.
I don't know. I've never met the man, and I don't intend to. In this five-volume work, as we've mentioned several times, in volume two, there's a whole, I don't know how many pages, 50 or something pages, devoted to the concept, to the eretz, a whole entry, a long entry on Hishtanut HaTva'im, how nature has in fact changed since Talmud HaKam. In other words, it's taken for granted that the rabbis of the Talmud could never have made a mistake. Rabbinical infallibility is a given. Therefore, anything which is found today, contrary to biological or physical or astronomical or chemical or any assertions in the Talmud, cannot be due, chas v'shalom, to the fact that the rabbis were in error, but has to be due to the fact that nature has changed. So what was perhaps a cover or a euphemism for, and of course might even have actually been true, for example, certainly nature has changed as far as the laws of Mitzitza is concerned with the advent of AIDS. I don't think anyone would now, when it becomes a really life-threatening business, then the situation has changed entirely. So there will be changes in nature, but this is not the point of this entry into the encyclopedia. The point of the entry into the encyclopedia is that there's no mention of possible error on the part of the rabbinical authorities, and therefore, whenever we see a contradiction between today's observed facts and rabbinical statements, it must be because nature has changed. Many, many examples.
The world was flat.
For example. Many, many examples. But now, of course, since we understand that rabbis could not possibly have made an error, but nature could possibly have changed, we're faced with a halachic problem of how do we determine whether, in fact, nature has changed? You know, how do we know this? If we see it with our own eyes, okay, that's one thing. But is it possible to rely on experts, on doctors, for example, who tell you that nature has changed? Can you believe them? Can we believe the scientists when they tell us, in fact, some assertion of physical, chemical, or biological fact contrary to the Talmud? Do we have the right to believe them? So he lists a whole list of opinions.
Just my own point. Later on, you have the Mishnah Shabbos.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to come to that. Yes, just a moment.
Same person.
Yesh shekatvu. Yeah. Yesh. But I didn't emphasize this point then. Yesh. I'm reading now from Professor Steinberg, Professor Dr. Steinberg's article. Yesh shekatvu. Sharak im rofe echad omer she'ein sakana ma shechazal kavu. If the rabbis tell you that there is a danger in some procedure, like doing without matzitza, for example, if one doctor says that this is not dangerous, then you shouldn't pay any attention to it. But, he says, there are some who say that aval imu daval niskam etzel kol harofim she'ein sakana, if all doctors agree that there's no danger in this particular procedure or lack of this procedure, as somchim al harofim. Then, in other words, some rabbinical authorities say that if there is absolute universal agreement amongst doctors, then you don't consider something that's stated in the Talmud as dangerous, as, for example, in our case, as actually being dangerous. In a footnote, he says, he cites this particular opinion to Rav Eliashiv. Okay? And he says, Umashi yesh lahakshot al dvarav, but you certainly can question if this is a difficult statement to accept, says Professor Steinberg. It's very hard to agree that if all the doctors say that something is not dangerous, that we should believe these doctors as opposed to the Gemara. Sheyehe mutar lebatel et hamatzitza. If we accept this position, then we should be able to dispense with matzitza, because every single doctor in the world today will tell you that there's no danger involved in not performing matzitza. And that, obviously, he says, is impossible. Ella. Or every single doctor in the world will say that there's no danger in omitting mitzitza, and to the contrary, there is a danger of infection if you perform mitzitza. Therefore, how can Rabbi Eliashiv maintain his position? Yesh lomar sheshitato, we must say that according to Rabbi Eliashiv, ka'otam ha-svarim she'ikar tamo mitzitza eno mishum sakana ela mitamim acherim. We must say that Rabbi Eliashiv will agree with those other authorities who maintain that there's a higher, more serious reason for the commandment of mitzitza than mere medical one, and therefore he will continue with tzitza despite the fact that it's not regarded as a danger. So notice the inverted logic here. The logic is that obviously we do not want to cancel mitzitza. This is a given. This is a theological given. Therefore, we must conclude from this either that Rabbi Eliashiv had some other hidden reason for mitzitza, and therefore was willing to take the daring statement that we pay attention to a universal agreement on medical matters of all doctors, or Professor Steinberg's opinion is more likely that Rabbi Eliashiv's position, namely that universal medical opinion can contradict the Talmudic statement, should not be accepted.
I would just ask Rabbi Eliashiv.
I'm sure he didn't want to. Okay, so notice the weird situation. A millennium ago, Rav Shrira Gaon was willing to say that rabbis were not doctors, and we don't have to pay attention to them. 500 years ago, almost, 400 and some odd years ago, Shulchan Aruch was willing to say that the practice of dispensing with the washing of the child, we can do without that because in the time of the Talmud this was regarded, or perhaps was, dangerous, and today it isn't. 150 years ago, the Chatam Sofer could say, of course you can dispense with the mitzitza because the doctors today have better forms of medication and alternative means of dealing with this problem. Okay? In this decade, mitzitza has become a flag commandment to the extent that it's impossible to imagine that it can be dispensed with, to the extent that you have to reject the notion that even if there's universal agreement among doctors which contradicts the Talmudic statement, we ignore the doctors and follow the Talmudic statement.
Is it dangerous to carry this all the way? If the doctors come out with a statement that circumcision is a danger, it's time to knock off the halakha and dispense with circumcision. What happens is enough. What's going on? Maybe he's got his point, is that we can't be so quick to make a decision.
But this is not circumcision. This is a purely piece of medical advice. The Talmud never claimed that mitzitza was an integral part of the circumcision ceremony. The Gemara did not say that it was part of the circumcision ceremony. It said that it was done for medical reasons. There is no logical extreme here. The logical extreme that has been carried here is the extreme that Professor Steinberg has carried it to. And it's unfortunately...
He went to Shari Tzedek.
I would not advise going to Shari Tzedek.
What does he do there?
He's the head of the neurology department, I think. I'm not sure. One or the other. You can look in the beginning of the book.
I don't get twitch in that.
Oh, I know we have a disease that's not covered in the Gemara.
His son is over there.
That's a problem.
Okay, now, the question is, how did this come about? How did this strange state of affairs come about? And on this, Professor Katz and I have a slightly different take, and that was the issue of that telephone conversation that we had many years ago, even though it probably wasn't brought out in the open. So let me summarize briefly what Professor Katz's position, explanation is, and then, and of course I agree with his explanation, I just don't think it's the whole story, and then we will come back to a slightly more ideological confrontation here. Professor Katz first points out, or he may not quite point it out, at least he pointed it out in conversations with me, I'm not sure whether he mentions it in this article, that the first of all, the distinction between Mitzitza and the other business of washing the child before and after is, of course, a sociological one. The Mitzitza is something that's done immediately as part of the ceremony. That is, the traditional ceremony was that the lawyer would perform this, that, and the other thing. The last, the other thing being Mitzitza. So, in contrast to washing the child, which was something that came earlier or later or even on the third day, which was not visibly part of the ceremony. So that was the first item. Secondly, there was, as you said, some controversy over circumcision itself in the Reform element, and therefore the rabbis, after the time of the Chatam Sofer, began to think that any attack whatsoever on any portion of the circumcision ceremony would be construed by the general populace as an attack on tradition and an attack on the halacha and on the ceremony. And this became increasingly a flag object within the Germanic and Central European communities. The key step being the discussion of this point in the Shomer Tzion HaNe'eman, the journal of Rabbi Ettlinger, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, whose brief biography together with a picture I've appended to the handout. So that by the last third of the 19th century, Mitzitza had become a dividing issue. If you were an Orthodox Jew in Germany, you had Mitzitza performed, and if you were not, that was already a sign that you were suspect or reformed. On the other hand, there were various both aesthetic and medical objections to the procedure, and therefore various different alternatives were proposed. For example, the first one that we saw was the sponge, the second one was some kind of a sucking through a pipette, the third one was some kind of a mechanical suction device. Various different devices were performed, and all of this had more or less agreement by some of the rabbis and not by others. But within the framework of the German communities, this was still a flag issue. In Eastern Europe, with the advent of more knowledge about infection and so on and so forth, the rabbis, while still defending Mitzitza, were tolerant of the fact that Mitzitza was not being performed. And in more and more communities in Eastern Europe, for example, the official rabbinical position was one of tolerance of the absence of Mitzitza, but not any official certification.
Did they validate the circumcision if they didn't perform? In other words, if a reform
No. Never went to that stage. But it did go to the stage that where, if you didn't perform Mitzitza, you were regarded as, say, what would happen to you today if you prayed in a shul without a machitza, or with a mixed...
would they marry? I mean, would they accept that dead child in the in an Orthodox family?
Well, you would be, you'd have a certain stigma attached to you if you actually...
No, he's talking about the child, you're talking about the moel.
I'm talking about the moel and the parents.
Right. Remember, the child, about no child. Question at all.
The child, no. But the child would be no question at all, but
be accepted.
The child would certainly be accepted, but the fact, the act itself, or the refusal to accept the act, would have been elevated to something of a flag signal, something that stood for whether you were truly Orthodox or not. And this was the case in Western Europe, and in Hungary especially, but not the case in Eastern Europe, where there was a certain amount of tolerance. With of course, the combination of the Hungarian strictness together with the Lithuanian yeshivot overtaking the entire Orthodox world as of today, we can understand that this flag issue has again been revived, and that's the explanation for that's Professor Katz's would have been Professor Katz's explanation for something like this encyclopedia Hilchatit Rufuit, which of course he didn't, I don't think actually saw. Now, my take on this is, well, you've all read the article of Professor Katz, so I mean it's pointless in my going over it in much more detail, but we should read some of the sources. My take on this is that there was this ideological component, and the ideological component became more severe as time went on, and this was precisely the issue of whether Chazal could or could not have made a mistake, even on something like medical matters. So that while it was conceivable for Rav Shkriva Gaon to explicitly say that the rabbis were not doctors, by the end of the 19th century, and certainly by the end of the 20th century, the notion of rabbinical infallibility had become part of the dogma. And therefore, this is part of the phenomenon as to why a medical doctor who's a professor at a major hospital can actually write that nature has changed and the rabbis were not in error.
Correct, and there was always people saying, you know, anyway, so why just now on medical practice?
Because it's a conflict between statements of fact, of science, which go and contradict even universally accepted statements in the Talmud. And how could the Talmudic rabbis actually have been in error? And I think we have to, let's take a look at this by now going precisely to the initial article by the Tiferes Yisrael, which Professor Katz called me about this 10 or 12 years ago. So let's read, it's on my page, the Mishnah starts on my page 6. And then but we'll quickly go to the Tiferes Rabbi Eliezer Omer, this is the Mishnah, Lo hivi kli mi'erev Shabbat nevi'o v'Shabbat megula v'sakana nechaseru al-pi edim v'od amar Rabbi Eliezer kotim eitzim lasot chamim lasot klei barzel kol amar Rabbi Akiva kol mocha she'eshar l'yasotam mi'erev Shabbat eino dochat ha-Shabbat o she'eshar lasot mi'erev Shabbat dochat ha-Shabbat osim kol tzokei mi'la v'Shabbat mohalin u'kor'in u'mosetzin v'notnin Allah esplanit Ukumo, etc. Okay. And now let's take a look in the Tiferet Yisrael. So it's the Tiferet Yisrael was the rabbi in Danzig in the first half of the 19th century. So a little bit later, perhaps late contemporary of the Chatam Sofer, a bit later, and well versed in many things. And he wrote a running commentary on the entire Mishnah, together with various excursions into relevant current topics of current interest. So let's take a look down in the left-hand column, which is entitled Boaz, right? Perk Yutet Aleph. Let's read this slowly. Ulefi masha omrim haro'im achshav. According to what the doctors say today, adaraba, adyidei hamatzitsa, efshashi yistakein. It's the contrary. Matzitsa can actually cause danger. Sha'al yedei ha-matzitsa yitparzu nikvei the pores, ha-porim, v'yishas'u dam achar ha-mila, that this will cause the blood to flow after the mila. So he misunderstands what the actual danger of the matzitsa is. He thinks that sucking on the blood will cause hemorrhaging. Sucking on the wound will be a cause of hemorrhaging, and in fact he has a bit of a wacky physical explanation as to why this is going to cause hemorrhaging. Kemotzeitz yayin shebachavit al yedei haber. It's like sucking wine from a barrel by a siphon. right? This, once you draw out the blood, you're going to have a siphon effect, and then the blood will continue to flow, just as wine continues to flow out of the barrel once you've gotten the siphon initially to be started. Once you've drawn out the air from the siphon, miyad hayayin shefachtav nimele poreitz va'oleh af achal shefatzach sak l'tzotz v'halim. That once you started to suck the wine out of the siphon, the wine will continue to flow even though you're no longer sucking anymore. So similarly, he sort of misunderstood the effect here as saying that the blood will continue to flow.
Get rid of the coagulant, you know, where it
starts
to congeal, then it will...
That's not what he said. He's talking about a siphon. I mean, it's quite...
It continues to flow in the same way a siphon continues to flow. It's not saying it is a siphon effect.
What else is he saying? Why is he bringing the siphon all together? If you said that
once you get something started, it can continue to flow.
Like a siphon.
Like a siphon.
Right.
Using it as an analogy.
He's saying it's going to...